Okay.
EMS 8730. Hello, caller?
Relax, relax. We're trying to help you here.
This is not a job for everybody.
Losing fib now.
This is not a job to get rich or stuff like that.
Calm down. Everything's going to be okay.
We're the doctors of the street. That's what we are.
Welcome to EMS Office Hours. This is Jim Hoffman.
And this is Josh Knapp. EMS Office Hours is a live, weekly EMS podcast for all EMS professionals.
Discussing a variety of EMS topics and bringing your EMS concerns to light. So turn down that scanner and turn up your speakers.
And join us to find out what's really on the minds of EMS.
How the show tonight, we're going to talk a little bit about using two IVs in trauma patients and whether or not it's really necessary, how maybe your agency does it. So please feel free to give me a call while we're on the air here. You can call in as a guest at 877-217-3924, and be more than happy to go ahead and take your comments with that. Real quick, I know we got a late start, but I do just want to mention a quick webinar coming up tomorrow, the 25th of August. It's going to be on medical math. So I'm going to be doing that tomorrow. Actually, it's going to be a live replay from a while back with the guest speaker, Gus Buck Ferris, is the guest speaker on it, and does a really great job on explaining medical math and drug calculations and things like that. So it promises to be a really good webinar tomorrow. It's going to be two plays. I'm going to be doing it at 2 p.m. and also at 8 p.m. You can go ahead and sign up. I'm going to put the link below in the show as well in case you might have enough time to get in on it before tomorrow. It's ems4.us/medmath. So pretty easy URL, but I'll make sure I go ahead and post it in the show notes. You can take advantage of this free webinar. It's about 90 minutes long, but again, really well worth it. Buck really breaks down the simplest form and the most understandable form on how to understand drug calculations and medical math. One other quick note before we get into tonight as well is next week there will not be a live show of EMS Office Hours. I will be in EMS World Expo in Las Vegas, so I will not be able to go ahead and do a live show. So I'll probably try to throw up some type of replay or something like that for next week. So there'll be something on the blog at emsofficehours.com. But just so you know, if you do tune in regularly as a live call, as a live listener, there won't be a live show next week. So with that said, I'm basing tonight's discussion, or going to try to anyway, around an article that I read, and it was kind of a popular article, got some feedback on, a lot of views, so I thought it would be good to kind of maybe delve into it a little bit deeper, and talking about using one or two IVs for trauma patients. And you know, the article was by Kenny Navarro, and he's an EMS1.com contributor there. And he talked a little bit of some research that was done on the benefits of this or not. And they found out, or they feel, that the second IV is not really affecting patients, is not really having any change in blood pressure and heart rate and SpO2, even in things like the patient getting rehospitalized for the trauma, or even mortality rates. So my question is, of course, is why are we doing this second IV? I mean, is it just because it's one of those things that are in EMS that we're just doing it just to do it? We're doing it because it's in, you know, some written protocol, because it's expected of us in the field to get two large bore IVs. I mean, that is like something that's drilled into our heads, you know, as medic students, is any trauma patient gets two large bore IVs, you know, two large bore IVs and fluid. And more it's getting looked at where the idea of all this fluid that we're giving to patients is not really doing all that much good for them, and in some cases can actually be harming these trauma patients as well. So I believe I've got it looks like I have Tim on the line with me. Tim, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, Tim, how you doing?
Okay, how are you?
All right. And I think Josh is with us, too. I think he was having some audio issues, too. Let me double-check. Josh, are you with me as well?
I should be, Jim. You hear me?
Yeah, I gotcha. I gotcha. So, sorry, guys, sorry about the delay. I had my Skype up, and for some reason I was not seeing either of you, and Skype and the Blog Talk Radio switchboard that I use here was not identifying me as even being called in. So I apologize for that, guys, and anyone listening for that. I'll try to edit that out of the official broadcast over on the blog. But in any event, this is something I think where we start drawing that line again. And we've talked about this, I think, the three of us many times on the show too, as far as the differences between, you know, following those protocols, everything that's in writing and that's drilled into us, and using more of our clinical, you know, skill and being responsible for our impression of the patient and how we treat or don't treat a patient, rather than following, you know, those cookie cutter type guidelines. And this two IV, the two large bore IV, you know, mentality for every trauma patient is, I think, one of those situations. Tim, I'm going to ask you first, because I know you're a little bit more into the research on this. And off the top of your head, I mean, do you have any information as far as the extra fluid and how that can be beneficial or detrimental to trauma patients?
Well, Dr. Dutton, who has done a couple of talks on this on MCRIT, says we should not be giving any fluid to trauma patients unless it carries oxygen or it increases the ability of the blood to clot. Since what we carry does the opposite of both, it's probably a bad idea. And
yeah,
as far as
say,
I know, there's no research that really supports it. It's just, hey, this seems like a good idea. Let's do it without thinking about it.
Yeah, I was just going to say that the stuff that we're carrying isn't really, you know, doing the clotting, and you still have the patient bleeding out, and it looks like what we're really doing in the end is just thinning out their blood even more with this fluid that we're giving them, you know.
Josh. I was recently in a combat tactical casualty care class, and it was a 2-day class of giving care under fire in combat conditions. And we had our instructors ranged from guys just out of combat from Iraq, Afghanistan, and to some of our folks in the NYPD ESU. And all of the information coming out right now is right where Tim said, is that if we're not giving fluid that is going to promote oxygen saturation, we really shouldn't be giving fluid at this point. It's unless you're giving something like whole blood, or you know, in a surgical setting, or even a pre-surgical setting, the patient is not going to benefit from it. And as a matter of fact, one of the thoughts behind this was that for tens of thousands of years, we've adapted to injury in the field with no fluid, no extra fluid being given to us. And so our bodies have actually created a compensation mechanism for that. So it's you know, right now, the current thought is if you're wounded in the field, if you're hemorrhaging blood, you stop the hemorrhage, you know, stop the loss of blood. Tourniquets are very popular, and as a matter of fact, they finally come back into protocol in New York. And, you know, stop hemorrhaging and then transport. No fluid.
Yeah, I think tourniquets, too, they're back into National Registry as well in their testing, their skills testing guidelines also. It's interesting. I wonder, have you either one of you guys taken a PHCLS class recently? Are they still pushing the whole large bore IV? Are they still – I know they're big on the mechanism of injury as well in PHCLS also. I'm wondering if they're also kind of getting along, you know, in line with this thinking of two is unnecessarily better when it comes to, you know, trauma patients and fluid resuscitation.
I haven't.
Jim, I'll leave that to you. I haven't. Yeah.
No.
Not,
yeah, I
not
have. I'm going to have to look into that and see what they're teaching on that. I mean, I looked at some of the comments and some of the feedback and some of the forums regarding this article and in some of and actually on the EMS One page as well. And most people are pretty much in the same line of thinking that we're discussing as far as, you know, it's not necessarily beneficial for the patient when it comes to fluid. This is something, too, where we go back to this whole thing, which is it's really getting me to a point where I'm getting almost incensed with this thing as far as protocols and being almost forced to try to follow these protocols, or every time you don't or even deviate from it, you wind up sitting there and having to defend every single thing that you did. Even if your documentation is already defending it, it's like you have to defend it, you know, several times to people who want you to follow these protocols, that they do not want you to deviate. You know, if the protocol says two large bore IVs for a trauma patient, especially if you transport them to a trauma facility, that's what they want you to do. And,
well, we've got the wrong people in charge. For them, all about the protocol and forget about the patient. We don't care if you kill the patient as long as you follow the protocol.
Yeah, it's like that's what they want you to kind of follow through. It's almost like they have this mentality of, well, we can protect ourselves from litigation if we can prove that, well, we followed the written guideline that's put forth.
Well, they need to prove it.
Yeah, right, right.
Maybe
exactly.
They've just had some bad lawyers defending them. Maybe they just keep giving up and saying, well, this is getting expensive and we're not going to defend it, which only tells plaintiff's attorneys, hey, if we keep pushing this, they will settle at some point.
Yeah. And one thing in the article, too, that I thought was interesting is, you know, they bring up the also the perception of from the emergency department's viewpoint, you know, that they're expecting us to come into the – roll into a trauma, you know, trauma suite in an ER and have both IVs, you know, have two IVs established. And if you don't have it, it's like you look at you like you didn't do your job. Even if the patient isn't any worse for wear and there's nothing, that, you know, identifying that you did anything wrong, it's like they're looking at you like you didn't do everything you could for this patient. And part of the article even says that, you know, somebody, that the scenario they kind of gave, talked about how, you know, the nurse had mentioned, well, if you're going to be rolling into a trauma, call a whole trauma team down, you should have, you know, two IVs running.
Well, what
you know,
do we
my
care
answer
what they
to that,
think?
What's that,
yeah, my answer to that, what do we care what they think, he said.
Yeah.
my answer to that is, you know, look at your source. I mean, and that's, again, I mean, you may want to it's a good thing you're recording this because I'm agreeing with Tim on every single thing he said so far, which is sort of scary. I mean, is the moon out? Is it stars aligned or something? But,
both
you know,
moons
take
are
a look
out.
At your – ah, there you go. Take a look at the take a look at your average response to a code. I mean, look at your and look. I love the ER nurses that I work with, and I have great respect for the majority of them. But how many times have you come in and seen a code enacted where somebody's doing CPR on a 1/1000 beat? I mean, you know, we got to stop and recognize the source. You know, and if you have to protect yourself, I mean, look, I work in a system where, unfortunately, I have to play by the rules of the system. But every time there are rules, there are ways of working your way around the rules. Like there is within the protocol that says, hey, you know, I can't do more than two IV starts or two IV attempts. So if I've gotten a good IV, good large IV, my trauma patient is stable, blood pressure is stable, I really don't see the need for a second one. If they push comes to shove, I can always say, hey, second one was attempted. Maybe it was attempted in my mind, but they're not going to look for a needle stick and say, where was it attempted? You know, I mean, there's aspects that you need to CYA and play by the rules, and there's aspects that you absolutely must be a practitioner, use your good judgment, use your experience in the field, and treat your patient, not a protocol.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think, you know, it makes it difficult, I think, for us in the field to when we get these patients, you know, you get these trauma patients who aren't necessarily presenting with, low blood pressure and they're mentating well, but, you know, they've had some significant trauma going on, and you're going to take them to a trauma center because, you know, that's going to be the best place for them, but they don't necessarily need to have two IVs, and, you know, again, you wind up almost with your hands tied to, you know, do these two, IV lines. I mean, you know, it just seems to me that there has to be some way that we can start as an industry to get away from this, you know, protocol mentality, and use it for what there are is for guidelines, not at this hard and fast rule that everyone seems to think that they're there for. I mean, most people you talk to would tell you, well, protocols are there for, as a guideline. They're not there for this hard and fast, you know, rule. But yet so many people, and again, Tim, like you said, a lot of people follow that it's management and it's administration that seems to feel that the protocols are this hard and fast rule. And it's not leaving up to the field personnel to decide whether or not this is something that should be done or shouldn't be done. And I think that goes for...
Well, you get some engineers, people who are good with books, but not good with actual patient care. They haven't made that connection between the brain and the hand, and
right. They
don't know how to assess. They know that they can read a book and memorize the information, and these are the people who tend to get pulled off the street where they're dangerous and put into QA so that they've got something that they're good at. And administrators may not know anything about medicine. You may have somebody who bought the company because they had plenty of money. You may have a fire chief with no medical experience. You may have somebody who hasn't been a medic in 20, 30 years. Or you may have a first responder. You know, you could have anybody there.
Right.
Well, yeah, and you get into the realm of the Peter Principle, where a person rises to the level of their incompetence. And certainly we see a lot of that, and we see also a lot of, and I think, honestly, Tim, I would go more with what you said at the very beginning, where we tend to be a very litigious society. So organizations that are run tight to a budget tend to be very legally scared, and so they want to really toe the line. And you go to by whatever is the written established rule. Now, a lot of this isn't empirically based information. I mean, we could go back and we'd probably have another 3-hour conversation on longboards. I mean, there's no proof out there, and yet we are forced. I was, Jim, I tell you, I told you that I've been biking a lot lately. I was biking the other day. There was a low-level collision that occurred along the path. I rode up on it. Everybody's around this young lady. She's doing the woe is me dance. She was completely, you know, in the wrong. So she's lying down, just complaining of dizziness and everything else. Heart rate is 84. I didn't have a blood pressure cuff, but, you know, she was perfusing very nicely to have nice rosy cheeks, be alert and oriented and everything else. Not a scrape on her head, just on her knee, on her elbow. And somebody called an ambulance, and what do? They collar and longboard her. And it's like she was ambulating on the scene. She wasn't complaining of neck and back pain. Why did they do that? It's CYA. It's simply that in this day and age, people don't have the choice to go from one job to another. They got to keep their jobs, so they're going to cover their asses. And they're being rewarded by an administration that says, good job. You weren't thinking. You followed the protocol. You put them on. Now we won't get sued. And until we have some, you know, people that go and support the funding that does the research, which is a long way, you know, a big stretch, because a lot of people have other things to do with their money nowadays than fund research that might make a few percentage, a small percentage of the population more comfortable for a little while, you know, what's it going to do? I mean, look at how long it took us to adapt a Japanese standard for CPR, where they said, you know, this isn't cardioperfusion, this is cerebral perfusion. I mean, we're really slow on doing that because we have so many lawyers that are coming in, and if we're not towing the line, if it's not written down, they can't go to a book and say, see, it's in the book, that's what we did, we're not going to get out of this loop. That's my, you know, my humble
Fortunately,
opinion.
In Pennsylvania, Dr. Koop is trying to keep us up with the latest research. When it comes to oxygen, our goal is a SAT of greater than 94%. Whatever it takes to get them to 90, above 94%, even if it's room air or a nasal cannula in cardiac arrest, that's fine. You know, all that matters is that we're assessing the patient and treating the patient according to the assessment.
You know, it's funny.
And that makes perfect sense.
You know, it's almost as if it's like I almost want to just going on like a campaign against the lawyers involved in EMS, and it's like I would say 98% of the comments that I've read just on this one article are pretty much, again, all in line with what we're saying. You know, assess the patient and give the second IV as needed for that patient, and not just to do it for protocol reasons or, you know, because the ER is expecting it. I even I have a poll that I put up over on the blog at EMS Office Hours asking what most people feel about it. And I had about maybe 30-somewhat people respond to the poll so far. And I have one person who said it depends upon the blood pressure, and everybody else says that starting the second IV should depend upon the patient's presentation and what our impression is of the patient and not anything else. It's some of the other things I gave choices of, follow the protocol, and, you know, under all circumstances they get two IVs, and then the other two were depends on blood pressure, and yeah, the fourth choice was, you know, depends upon patient's presentation and what they're presenting as. And like, again, I think one person said that they feel it should depend upon the blood pressure, and everybody else is going with you know, depending upon the patient's presentation. So it doesn't seem like it's a provider issue to me. You know what I mean? It seems like it's more of a management thing that's kind of forcing everyone to keep following this, a legality thing that's forcing people to keep following
this. We're supposed to be doing what's best for the patient. If I get to the trauma center, sometimes I will tell them, hey, I only started one line because we're bouncing down the road. They don't have good veins. I figured I'd leave it for you to start a line when we get here. I haven't really had
Wait
any problems
second.
Saying
weren't
stuff
you,
like that.
Weren't you beating me up the other day about not starting an IV in a bus because you were bouncing down the road and they had lousy veins? Excuse me, you know? Come on. Can't have
Sometimes,
a wait.
Hey, as long as I've already got one line, I don't have a problem. I can give most of what I need to on that. If I'm looking at another site to start a line, yeah, I'll leave it for the hospital. Besides, most of them will not take bloods from EMS, so they need a good site to draw from.
Yeah, a lot of places. I mean, by me, they have you know, every ER has their own request for what blood tubes they want and things like that. And then when you get there, half the time they just take them and throw them and, you know, throw them out as soon as you get there.
Well, hospital policy in a lot of places is that they will not accept EMS bloods.
Yeah, by me, I have to I have to sit there with my try to squeeze in my name and the patient's name and the date it was, the time and date it was the blood was drawn, and this little bitty vial, you know, as they're trying to ask me questions about what was going on with the patient and the scene and stuff like that. I'm like, okay, wait a second, I have to fill this little information on this little bitty tag on
the
vial.
If you're going to a trauma center, usually what they do is they have pre-numbered tags because everybody goes in as anonymous, John Doe, first, get some of those before they're put on anything on the printout, it's a lot easier to write on them before you take them off and stick them on the blood tube.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why that they insist on the handwritten thing.
The lawyers
in the
there are mistakes in the lab, and it's not uncommon for mistakes to be made where somebody puts down a blood tube and then goes, you know, a phlebotomist goes to another room, draws blood from another patient, and gets them mixed up.
Yeah,
if you're dealing with a trauma, it's much less likely unless you have multiple traumas at the same time.
Right, right. I mean, in the past, they would just now, they would put they would have no problem. I would head in the blood, and they would put the stickers on there. I wouldn't have to do it. They would be doing it already
right, as
they got the patient. And, you know, you made a good point, too, Tim, as far as the second IV with a patient with bad veins. You know, we go under the assumption with these two large bore IVs that every trauma patient we have is going to have these great, you know, pipes for veins that we're going to stick them with a, you know, 16-gauge, you know, 14-gauge needle to get access. And, you know, it's like, yeah, that's in the perfect world. You know, and again, this goes back to, I think, guidelines as how they're – it's not hard – it shouldn't be hard and fast. It should be guidelines. And there are situations where, like you said, I didn't think it was necessary to start poking around this patient again. They were stable. Their vital signs were stable. They were mentating stable. You know, I didn't see the need to poke them around in a moving ambulance, you know, with poor vasculature just to satisfy some type of written, you know, rule that they think you should have been following.
And then you have to look at which catheters you're using. If you use a 14-gauge 1.25-inch catheter, that's going to flow a lot more fluid than a 14-gauge 3-inch catheter. And people don't take that into consideration. You might as well start a 16-gauge for the fluid flow. You can get it farther in, and it's less likely to come out with the 3-inch catheter, but it's not really what you want to be using for a vein in the arm. If they're going for a femoral line, yeah, it's more appropriate for that, but you would, you know, in the trauma center, they're going to be using something much longer.
Yeah. And, you know, one comment, one thing, and I know, Tim, I know you love this, but a lot of the people in these forums and the responses, they talk a lot about the what-if factor. You know, maybe it's not just for fluid resuscitation. You know, maybe it's for, you know, in case the first IV gets pulled out during transport, you know, things like that. You know, what if the first line somehow infiltrates? You know, now you have to start trying to get a second line while you're, you know, halfway into the call and you're not really, you know, paying attention. You're not aware what's going on with the first IV.
Well, and, isn't that true of every patient?
Sure.
Yeah. Right. You know, really, the way that you have to look at that is that we assess and then we always are in that what-if scenario. We're always looking and anticipating the next move. That's why in a cardiac patient where, hey, we don't have to give drugs right now, but they are showing a dysrhythmia, we're going to start an IV because, you know what, we may want to give them drugs and we're not going to want to break into that, you know, starting that IV and maybe getting it, maybe not. So the aspect is, you know, and the interesting part of the article was that it did help people with a blood pressure of lower than 60. And, you know, it's kind of interesting if you have a patient and let's say they're 100 and tacking away and they look like they have some good internal injuries and they look like they their blood pressure is dropping, they're diaphoretic. You know what? Even though they may be stable at 100, 110, 90 to 110, probably you're going to want to start that second line because you've taken that what-if scenario. I mean, you know, we have to play those odds. We have to play that, you know, there is a possibility of the patient tanking, so we want to be prepared for that. If we're sitting there and we feel the odds are low and the patient looks stable, we're using our clinical judgment, well, then you have a defensible position for not starting a second IV. You know, and you sort of have to take that back. Holy shit, you know what? We did have an earthquake already.
Two of them.
There you go.
Well, I mean, let me just say this. I mean, you know, I'm a big, you know, fan.
I thought Jim had fallen over.
Yeah, I know. I thought I heard a thump, too. But, you know, I'm going to say we need to be focused, I think, more on how the patient is presenting and less on guidelines. I encourage anyone listening to the show to go over to EMS12hours.com and take the poll, you know, so I can get maybe even a bigger count of opinions on this type of thing. I'd love to, you know, hear what other people are thinking on this as well. You know, but I want to go ahead and maybe just get into a little bit. I don't want to keep talking about the same thing. I think we're pretty much in agreement on this, and pretty much the people that have commented and left feedback on this article are in agreement too. I'm hoping that in the future that the field personnel are going to be able to start trying to direct how these protocols are written and you know, supposed to be followed, and stop with the, you know, treating them as if they're this hard and fast rule that cannot be deviated from under any circumstances. And if you do, you're all of a sudden this either, you know, perceived as some kind of a lackadaisy provider, or that you're not, you know, thinking about what's best for your patient. You know, so I'm hoping that in the end that's what's going to wind up happening. But of course, that's never guaranteed, and I'm sure it's probably way off and long and far away from me.
Jim, let me throw this at you. Don't you think that this is just a sort of a telltale of the inherent problems that are within the EMS system on how we do our patient approach, how we're perceived in the field, and how we're trained?
Well, I do. I do think that. I mean, even when I was thinking about this show tonight, I mean, I did a shorter little quick little thing I did on the golden hour, which is another thing that we wind up getting wrapped up in as well. You know, it's like, well, you know, you didn't take it to a trauma center. You know, you were on scene too long with this patient. You didn't choose the right transport method to get into a trauma center, you know, fast enough and meet that golden hour rule that supposedly, you know, it's supposed to be benefiting patients, which is another thing that hasn't really, you know, been shown to do much either. You know,
it's not based on any research. It's
right.
A sales tool that was used by R. Adams Cowley to get his Maryland trauma system set up, and he got it in place, and well, they keep selling it.
The funny thing is it was something like that. Is people are going, if you give a trauma patient and they're really, you know, a messed up patient, and a lot of things going on, a lot of different, you know, body systems happening, and you're doing a lot of different things for this patient, you're going to naturally move faster. You're going to naturally want to get into an appropriate facility in a timely manner. I mean, I don't think that's something we should be looking at our watch as soon as we get that trauma call and say, okay, you know, the golden hour starts now, and now I'm under the gun to do everything within that time frame. I think there are many places probably in the country where that's just not even feasible, you know, in some areas of the country to get patients to our trauma.
There are other places where from the time you get the call till the time the patient is at the trauma center can be less than 10 minutes.
Right.
It doesn't have a big effect on the longer transport time, but with your shorter transport time, extra time that you spend on scene can have a bigger effect on the total EMS time. But that's been studied and not found to have an effect on outcomes.
Is Josh, yeah. any thoughts?
The trouble is issues like this, and when we talk about these sort of cross issues where we're really betwixt and between administration and our own good judgment, you know, they have a special place in my heart because I've experienced them firsthand. I see them all the time, and they scare the heck out of me because, you know, we're not giving the patient their due. And, you know, all the time I remember, I mean, as an excited EMT in class, you know, the first time I heard you're to be an advocate for the patient, I was like, hey, that's something I can do regardless of the training that I have, because I'm going to say, hey, you know, this is an issue that we need to address on the patient's behalf, whether it's holding back an unneeded intervention or doing additional interventions that are outside of the box. Either way, we're putting our clinical judgment forward, we are assessing the situation and our patient, and we're doing the best thing we can for them. And, you know, on the show, what was it, 3 weeks ago, Jim, I was telling you about the lady who drove her car into, quote-unquote, into a building with no damage, and yet I had to bring her to a trauma center because a captain showed up on scene. You know,
I had one even worse than that. It was a guy who hit a curb, was arrested by the police for intoxication, and BLS ambulance called up the hospital, said we're coming in with this, and he developed some chest pain after he was told he was being placed under arrest. He said, oh, chest pain, trauma, you got to go to the trauma center. Call a medic and rendezvous on the way to the trauma center. So I meet him at the intersection of the highway. They're sitting there waiting, the police, the ambulance, everybody. And the guy says, no, I don't want to go to the trauma center. I'm fine. I just had a little anxiety, chest pain. Call up the doctor. He says, no, he's under arrest for drunk driving. He can't refuse. I said, no, he can refuse. He is answering all questions appropriately, and he is refusing to go to the trauma center. The doctor made me do a refusal on this. So rather than require that the patient go to a trauma center, he required that the patient not be seen by any doctor in order to avoid seeing the patient himself.
You know, and that's where your hands are tied, Tim. I mean, I agree completely that's bad judgment. And as a matter of fact, if you think about our spine clearing protocols, when can you not clear somebody from a longboard? When they're intox. I mean, with distracting injuries, all that other crap that goes along with it, that sort of leads you down the road that there could be a spine injury. But the other aspect is intox. Hey, you know what?
But what is intoxicated, and is it every little bit of alcohol? You take one sip, and you lose your ability to decide?
Why not? Because it counts for the law. You know, it counts for the law when you're operating a vehicle. I mean, certainly there are minimal areas, but now there are areas that have zero tolerance. You have one sip of alcohol, one drink, whether you're classified as an intox, whether your blood level shows it or not, you've been operating while intoxicated or quote unquote intoxicated under the influence. And so why is that there for the legal end so they can write you a large fine, but not there for the medical end so perhaps they could save your life or, you know, save complications down the road? I mean, well, we can't have this two-handed system.
The only thing that we should be looking at is, are they impaired? Can they determine that they have pain, do not have pain? And this is about using our judgment. And as you were saying earlier, the big problem we have right now with EMS is we seem to be coming up with ways to prevent people from using their judgment. National registry test is designed to be multiple choice. You have to choose the one best answer, even though there are many ways of treating any patient that will work. And the only way we know what's best is by the result later on. If I give you one treatment, it may work best for you. I give Jim another treatment, it may work best for him. And, rigid protocols do not allow for that. And a multiple choice test is not a way to assess understanding of anything. We have too many people who are graduates of these kind of programs that have these multiple choice tests as their final exam, and they're the ones who go on to management. And because they've learned to think like that, to play within that system, they think that everything should be that way. The real world is not a multiple choice test.
Don't you find sometimes that some people also that have been out in the field that, once they go into management, they get into that mentality of just following the book? They kind of slowly forget, the things that the field personnel are put under and the the judgments that the field personnel have to make, you know, on scene and for patients that they feel is best for the patient. I mean, nobody out there is, I think, making judgments to cut corners. I mean, you know.
But they also seem to be selective about which things are by the book and which things are, oh, well, we don't pay attention to that rule because, well, that would be inconvenient for management. It's only when it's convenient for management that they say, this is the way we have to do it. Then we have a way of saying, we complied with that, therefore we have no liability. Well, we always have liability.
You know, I can't believe I'm about to say this because, I mean, I 100 years ago in my last career, I was in management, and there is an aspect that I can be sensitive to them, but, you know, since I've been in EMS, I haven't seen the same caliber of management, and I think that's because of our assumption that, you know, well, you were good at this, so we're going to promote you, okay, you're good at that, and you see the Peter principle again. And, you know, what I sort of feel is that for the people that are defending a particular point, Tim, is that they have come to exist within an environment where that is their currency. You know, it's now they have to address the people who are looking at the spreadsheet, looking at the monies in and monies out, and they're saying, what have you done for me for cost-cutting in your department? What have you done for me for making more money in your department? And unfortunately, a large part of that cost-cutting or making money is not getting sued. And their only avenue to turn around is to say, well, it's a documented situation. That's what we're going off of. We played by the set rules. So instead of going after management in this case, we have to turn around and say, who are the rule makers? Who are the people that are either doing or not doing the research? And then even following that trail back further, why is that research not being done? Because the public doesn't know it's going to affect them.
Yes, and a lot of it isn't even the research. It's the people saying, well, if you do this, you will get sued. And you ask them, provide some documentation of that, and very rarely will any of them have anything to back it up, but they'll swear that if you do something, you'll get sued. And regularly, I will do what they tell me I can't do, and I have yet to be in court for any of it. And I have not gotten in trouble from the doctors because one of the first things I'll do is talk to the doctor about it. This
well,
is what I did. This is why.
You may get frustrated by a boss telling you, you know, to do something in such and such way because that's the way the system has said for it to be done. And it may not be in the patient's best interest. But can you really blame that boss? Because they're looking to protect their job the same way everybody else is.
I don't think ignorance is a good defense. If they don't know what they're basing what they're doing on, they need to find out. And one of the problems is we don't have good management training for EMS. One of the places where I used to teach got rid of their master's degree program and bachelor's degree programs in EMS because there was not enough interest in it. Well-respected university, and they just eliminated all of it. You know, we don't have a good place to send people in EMS to learn how to be good EMS managers. You can send them to any business school, but they don't understand what the risks are in EMS, what the methods of quality control, quality improvement, CYA, whatever you want to call it, that are used, what works, how to deal with employees. Yeah.
Well, the other aspect, and it's a glaring one, is not necessarily just because you have EMS experience will you make good EMS management. You know, business discovered this a long time ago, and if you start a company, you are expected to, quote-unquote, have an exit strategy. The investors in that company, hey, you're great, you're an entrepreneur, you started this company, you made it into something, you had the vision, now get out. Because there's a whole different mentality from creating something, you know, and inventing and moving forward and innovation and then running the day-to-day. So, you know, we
Definitely.
Have something where a guy might be a fantastic, even a fantastic field supervisor, but that doesn't mean that this person can be up there, you know, interfacing with the, you know, the higher levels that put the financial pressures on a department to be effective and also manage down lower again. I mean, there's no – why are we anticipating that that's going to work out?
What we should do maybe is have some lawyers go after EMS agencies for all of the nonsense things that we do just because they're a protocol. You know, like every time a patient who is fully spinally immobilized has an actual spinal injury, sue them. Make them prove that it wasn't the spinal immobilization that caused the injury. Because the only research out there shows that patients did worse when they were immobilized than in the system where they weren't.
I want anybody who's listening to this show and they're working in EMS on the East Coast to really batten down the hatches and be careful this weekend with the hurricane coming, because we're going to have a combination of things here. Tim and I are dead
in a volcano.
In agreement. And in a volcano. I mean, something's going to shift. I mean, we are dead. This has been my biggest – if the lawyers actually took a look at all the unnecessary crap that was put onto a patient and made the patient go through a level of discomfort that never had to be done, and there's no empirical evidence on that, on a reasoning to do it, holy crap, you could make a – I mean, that's a law firm in and of itself. I mean, that's a practice in and of itself. And then maybe we'd see some innovation in what we do in the field.
And our reimbursement from Medicare and stuff is our reimbursement for Medicare is also based on, you know, this is the only way to do it. If you treat somebody on scene but don't transport, you're generally not getting reimbursed. As I understand, that has exceptions to it, but not a lot of people are aware of them, and they may only apply in very limited circumstances, and the reimbursement may be small. We get paid based on miles traveled with a patient and based on ALS or BLS according to generally the Medicare guidelines. And that's something that needs to change.
And just to harp on it again, if we went back and did CPR based on where those guidelines originated from, we'd still be pulling people backward over a barrel. I mean,
it depends on what kind of barrel it is.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, guys, I mean, management has a hard job in EMS. I mean, I was an EMS manager for a while, and I actually wound up quitting because of some of the things we've talked about, you know, kind of having my hands tied and being forced to, you know, go with the grain type thing, and wound up quitting, and a few years later went back under a different director because he was more in line with my way of thinking. Being in that position, I understand it's a hard job, and it's sometimes you can't always, you know, want to just kind of be like this freelancing type thing, and it's easier, I guess, at times for management to just follow the written rule and expect their employees to do the same, because it's safer, it protects them, or at least perceivingly protects them from litigation. But at the same time, it seems to me that just looking at and anything we talk, like even tonight talking about everything with the IV, the golden hour, even talking a little bit about this reimbursement issue. It seems that the field personnel, the field provider, you know, looking at all the blogs that are out there and other podcasts and things like that, everyone seems to be on the same page as far as what we're talking about. I mean, so it's like, where do we find that disagreement or that blockage to kind of get it out of there so that we can do and provide care for patients and you know, transporting them and things like that. to the way that we want to do it as providers, as the people out there in the field. Now, where's that blockage, you know, to get it? It seems everybody else seems to be on board. So where is that blockade?
Yeah, Jim, let me be clear. I'm not beating up on the managers here. I really am being sensitive to the idea and empathetic that they are between a rock and a hard place. They have to do the song and dance of their bosses, and they're trying
to. And
they
have to have a spine, too, though. That's the thing.
If we don't give them the empirical data to have that spine with, they have nothing to support it with. And that's going to come from – that comes from research, and lo and behold, top of the food chain there are doctors.
In Pennsylvania, one of the things written into the law is that research may not be initiated by a paramedic.
It's actually in law?
I think I've seen that somewhere. Yeah, I think I've seen – or I'm actually might have been – Tim, you might have said it before on a previous –
Which just means you need to get a doctor to, start things out or to sign on with it. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that, although the study on 10% dextrose use in England or Australia, I forget which it was, but that was done entirely by two paramedics. Something that's rare.
But it's like you almost get frustrated of how our hands are tied with things, and I wish there was, unfortunately, I guess there's no overnight cure to...
Almost get frustrated?
Well, yeah. I try to have attitude. I tried to work within the guidelines, but at the same time, I get called in for giving half an amp of dextrose, and why didn't I give the full amp? And why didn't I do something for a patient that there isn't a written protocol for, but because somebody felt that it would have been more beneficial to do something for an asymptomatic patient instead of just taking to the hospital. So it gets frustrating.
Jim, I'm going to regret this. I'm going to regret this, but I'm going to throw a ray of sunshine here and be the Pollyanna and say that what our hope is enlightenment within the ranks, and that gains pressure and gains if we question why these things are done. So shows like what you've put together here on Blog Talk, blogs like what Tim is doing, being vocal how I am doing, and how all three of us get together and discuss these topics and bring them up, that's where our hope does lie. I mean, the more if it's never discussed, it will remain ignorant of it, and it'll never get addressed. Here, at least, we're bringing it to the surface, and we ask these questions. And the last thing that we all come together in agreement on is, hey, we're the practitioners in the field. We're the hands-on of the patient. Use your judgment. I mean, if Tim hasn't said it enough, I'm going to say it right here. I mean, use your frickin' judgment.
And we need to educate people to be able to assess properly and to, get experience using their judgment so that when they do, they're actually making good decisions. Because that's something that when we discourage people from using their judgment, when they finally do have to use their judgment, they'll end up making bad decisions because they're not used to doing it. They don't know how to make a good decision. They've made decisions based on, well, if I do this, I'll get spanked, so I'm not going to do this.
So it has to be a mix of cover your ass, work within the rule sets, but use your judgment and know how to intervene on behalf of the patient. I mean, listen.
The CYA, I'm more interested in protecting the patient, and I think if I do what's best for the patient, I do what's best for me. And Gene Gandy is a medic and a lawyer, has been around for a long time, and one of the most respected people in EMS law. The one thing he keeps saying is the best way to avoid getting sued is to do what's best for the patient. Not to say, well, this is what will keep me from getting in trouble with management, or this is what the medical director wants, but to do what's best for the patient. Because when you're in front of a jury, it's 12 people who have never worked in EMS, and the one thing they want to hear is, I was doing what I thought was best for the patient.
Yeah, that's a good point, Tim. Listen, guys, I want to end here because I think we made some really good points tonight. I think that, I think one of the biggest points is that we need to keep educating ourselves and new people coming in to what is going to be best for the patient and what we can do to try to move that along in the industry. And, you know, maybe that's going to be some research. Maybe it's still keeping the voice going that we have with these podcasts like this and, you know, EMS Garage and Educast and all that and blogs like Tim's, and just keep pushing and hopefully eventually it's going to start to slowly change and maybe look back and our names will be somewhere showing that we kind of spearheaded these changes that are going on in the industry. So thanks for joining me, guys. I really appreciate it and had a great time tonight as always.
Thanks for having
me. It's a pleasure.
All right. Have a great week. Well,
enjoy Vegas, man.
I'm going to try. Well, everyone, just about out of time tonight. So I want to thank you for joining us here on EMS Office Hours. I want to thank Josh and Tim for joining me and taking part in the conversation. And anyone that popped in the chat room, thanks for joining me there as well. Again, remember, EMS Office Hours is dedicated to you, the EMS professional. And I want to talk about what you're thinking regarding the EMS industry. So be sure to comment on the show over at the blog at emsofficehours.com, or you can send me an email direct. It's jhoffman@ems-safety.com, and let me know your concerns in the industry. Even if you want to talk about and bring up a recent call you had that you thought was interesting, I'll be sure to go ahead and try to fit it into an upcoming episode and show your thoughts with the EMS community. So thanks again for joining me. This is Jim Hoffman from EMS Office Hours, and as always, stay safe.